When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a variety of fascinating guests discussing the human side and impact of crime, not only on their lives, but mine as well. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, please contact Lifeline or any other support service or person that you feel comfortable with. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs and not everyone will agree with them. I understand that and I hope you do too. Thank you.
Inside this vault in one corner, and then at the other end is the 8 black barrels, and we can see handcuffs, we can see like a knife set and things, and some rubber gloves sort of been hastily removed on top of the barrels, and thought, okay, this has suddenly gone really pear-shaped.
With a lazy 36 plus years combined experience with both South Australia Police and Queensland Police, with a forensic background having attended a range of emergency incidents, examining major crime scenes, bombings, profile serial killings, and a myriad of suspicious deaths, organised crime gangs, etc., today's guest, Gordon Drake, was forced to leave Queensland Police Service purely because he turned 60. And that is the rules. Gordon loved his work and excelled in his field of forensic examinations. He was at the top of his game with so much knowledge and insight into forensic examinations. Just what a waste is that? Gordon would return to Queensland Police Service at the drop of a hat. But the catch is that if, after their forced retirement at 60, they wish to rejoin, they actually have to go back onto the front line. And I don't know about you, but I reckon a 60-year-old is never going to be able to outrun a fit or maybe even unfit 20-year-old. But they're the rules. Gordon and I started our respective policing careers in 1987, and we both acknowledge policing was so different back then. Crooks knew that we called the shots, so to speak, but it's done a full 360 now, it seems. The crooks treat police with disdain and utter contempt. Fancy watching a young kid high on, I don't know, whatever, speeding past you in a stolen car, maybe even giving you, or probably even giving you the bird, and you can't chase them. Gordon and I both agree that we'd struggle big time with those type of directions and instructions these days, not to chase them or whatever those instructions are. I could be being naive, but all it would take is a simple rule change to enable Queensland Police Service to keep people like Gordon with their extensive experience and knowledge and developing junior staff to just walk out the door. It just seems so wrong. In fact, in a way, it's got to be age discrimination, doesn't it? Anyway, is that age discrimination, do you reckon, Gordon?
Well, hello, and
welcome.
thank you, Noelle. Thanks for the chat. It would be age discrimination, but Queensland, being unique as Queensland is, actually has an exemption. They have their own exemption for police officers and specifically fire officers, fire brigade people, because they're subject to the same sort of crazy rule, but the fire brigade can stay till 65. But for the fire brigade and the police in Queensland, they have a special exemption in their human rights laws that allow them to to finish us at 60 and 65 respectively.
But as I said initially, it does seem a waste, doesn't it? Like here you are at the top of your game, at the top of the tree, and just because of an age barrier, you've got to stop. And I just think about all those, as I said in the intro, I just think about all those junior members that could learn so much. Like even if, let's say, you weren't operational, but you could still mentor them. And I just think it's a terrible waste. But as I keep saying, rules are the rules.
Yes.
Anyway, so look, thank you very much for joining us today, Gordon, on this very, very cold and dreary day in Melbourne. What's it like? Where are you? Are you Queensland?
I'm on the Gold Coast in Queensland, and it's a beautiful day here. In fact, I've just taken
my jacket off. Okay, that's enough. Yeah, that's enough. Thank you. Well, we're freezing our bits off here. That's bits. And it's about 7 degrees, I think, at the moment. So, the Gold Coast, that'd be beautiful. How long have you been up there?
We came here in the middle of 1999. I moved up from SAPOL. So, yeah. June of 1999, left South Australia and moved up here.
So. Okay. I couldn't leave Melbourne. I like the four seasons in one day. You just never know. You've got to have a jumper. I was going to say a pair of bikinis, but it's a long time since I've worn them. Anyway, again, thanks for joining us, Gordon. So as I mentioned in my introduction, you've been involved in many high-profile investigations, including serial killings, bombings, suspicious deaths and organised crime, just to name a few. I know that you could talk about it underwater and probably get asked it a million times, but many of my listeners wouldn't have heard about your involvement with the Snowtown murders. They called them the body in the barrels, or they may not even be aware of that investigation. So I know you talk about this ad nauseum, but would you mind giving us a quick précis of that investigation and your involvement? Because that is probably one of the most high-profile murder investigations in Australia, I would think.
Yes, I'd say it probably is one of the biggest. I think it might still be Australia's largest serial killings. I think it trumps the Ivan Milat ones as well, I think, on sheer numbers. But that was a job completely by accident. The job was never supposed to have been finding bodies. So, and there's a number of people that actually have never heard of it, see, because of the showing my age now, that many people have never really heard of the Snowtown murders, because it was back in 1999, in May, 20th of May. We were at a bank in Snowtown, a little country town in South Australia, about an hour and a half north of Adelaide. Lovely little town, famous for pretty much nothing at the time. Rural farmland surrounding it. Used to have a railway siding and those sorts of things. Typical, I suppose, the quintessential outback country town. That's not fully outback, you know, it's a country town in South Australia. Just off the main highway, they've got a bypass in there. So we had a series in South Australia, a series of people went missing over a period of years. The first one, it turned out, I think it was 1995, 91 even. That's how long it is, even I'm forgetting. We had a series of, it turned out, in the end, we ended up with 14 missing people were all murdered by a little gang of sort of three people. And they did have a fourth one, a young lad they were trying to sort of encourage and get involved along towards the end as well. But, we found most of those bodies in barrels. They were dismembered and put into 8 barrels inside an old disused bank vault at Snowtown. So that's pretty much the gist of the thing. Do you want any more information on that?
Feel free. Oh. The listeners could never get enough of – this sounds terrible, doesn't it, Gordon? But the listeners could never get enough of – like these are just – they're fascinating in one way, but from an investigation point of view, a terrible thing to say, but these sort of jobs they are something that a police person, they're great to be involved in because of the challenges. Like one murder in a barrel would be difficult enough, but it's hard to fathom 14 separate victims and how long did they get the people that were the offenders, how long did they get away with it before, you know, somebody made a report or they started digging and finding what was going on?
Well, it's sort of a funny thing funny, unusual. The whole job came from a fellow who I used to work with in uniform many, many years ago. When I first graduated, you know, you do general duties and patrol work and stuff. And I got stationed at Parra Hills Police Station. It existed back then in late 80s, 87. And I was working with a fellow called Greg Stone. We spent a few shifts working together in uniform. Eventually, we went our separate ways in our careers, and he ended up at the CIB office at Elizabeth. And he picked up a missing person file and went to and did some, you know, preliminary investigations with that, as police do, trying to find these people. And he didn't find the person, but eventually put it to rest, no further information, you know, file pending something else. And then he got another one a few months or so later, and he ended up with two or three of these, and he realised he was talking to the same people as he was doing his inquiries. He was coming across a number of similarities. He thought, well, why am I talking to the same people here? So he started digging a bit deeper, and good detective work, and he thought, there's something in this. These people, it's too coincidental that all these people, you know, they all work and operate in the same circles of friends. And so he went to his bosses and said, I think, you know, with something weird going on here. So as bosses do with junior detectives, you know, Stoney, you're a detective. It's a missing person. Move on. They're adults. You know, there's nothing to see here. Keep going. But he wouldn't let it go. He was like a dog with a bone, and he just kept plugging away. Thought, no, that's not right. So in between his other files, of course, he's trying to investigate these other things. And eventually he must have badgered his bosses to the point where they said, look, if you think there's something in it, go take it to major crime, like the homicide people, and, you know, see what they think. And this is his version. This is what he's told me. So he's gone up there into Adelaide. He's gone to the major crime people. And he told me at the time he suspected that the plan was that his bosses would then, you know, he'd come back with his tail between his legs, terribly embarrassed that the major crime squad have said, you're an idiot, you know, go away, little boy, run away. But instead, they went, you know what, we can see your point. He must have put a good file together. And they said, we can see what he's talking about. And from there, they started to put some work in from the major crime area, and that led to some surveillance and phone taps and those sorts of things. And then by the time we've got to May of April and May of 1999, they have got surveillance who have followed their prime suspect to this house at Snowtown, just a normal everyday sort of acreage type property in the heart of the township there. And so that's when I got involved. I got a phone call. At that stage I was working out of Cadena on the York Peninsula. That was my forensic area to look after. I had the whole York Peninsula, which is, for those people who are not familiar with South Australia, it's like a little boot-shaped part. It almost looks a little bit like Italy on the map. The little boot part of South Australia. So I'm living and working over there, and we've been relieving on a particular day. I'm across at New Ripta. I'm on way to New Ripta over towards the Barossa Valley because my opposite number over there was on leave and they had a job over there. So I went across to look at the remains of a vehicle that had been dumped at the side of the road. So I'm across there. Lovely sunny day it was. I still remember it. And the phone rang and I said, oh, yeah, it was me. And they said, are you available to go to Snowtown for a job? And I said, sure, you know, I can do that. And they said, the problem is we had two people teed up to come from Adelaide from the physical evidence section there. And they said, we were going to send them up today. It was all arranged. We got the tow truck organised as detectives and this, you know, the forensic team was set. But the forensic team got called out the night before to a murder. So they were no longer available. But they did have a relatively junior girl, a lady, that they could send up if I was available to sort of assist and supervisor. So I said, sure. So 11 o'clock was the meeting time. By the time I got back, I think it was about 11:15 when I got into the Snowtown police station. Walked in and there was Bronwyn and the other detectives and stuff. And they said, do you know about this job? I said, not really. And they said, well, hand me a piece of paper. The bottom half of the bit of paper had a whole list of items on it. Lounge suites, TV cabinets and TVs and stuff like that. And on the top half, there was five or six, eight or more names. And they said, all those people on the top of the list are missing people. All the stuff at the bottom of the list is property we know is missing from their houses. We know that our suspects have been followed to this address across the road here at Snowtown. We need to go over there, take some photographs, take a video of the inside and outside of the house, and we know there's a vehicle there that the suspect has driven, driven and left at that address. So we're going to seize that, and tow truck's out the front. So we're going to take the car on the tow truck, and we just want to record everything, and in case, you know, down the track we need to know what's going on with that. And they said we have the video and the photos, and then if anyone else says, oh, you know, uncle or auntie so-and-so has missed, this is missing from the house as well, they can look at those photos and see if that property's at this address. So the main focus was just to go and take, just a photo job. Just go and take some photos, take some video, which very easy, you know, from a forensic point of view.
In and out.
Yeah, pretty much. No worries. And I remember ringing my wife at the time and saying, look, I'm stuck at this job at Snowtown. I won't be home for lunch. I reckon I'll be late home for lunch. I'll see you about 2 o'clock.
Yeah, right.
I said, yeah.
What year?
I wasn't far out. It was 2 o'clock. It was just the following morning. But, I rang her and said, no, this is what's happening. So we went across and started doing the job, and they're talking to the occupant of this house and just having a chat. He's not a suspect at this stage. So we don't know what his involvement was. He lived there with his wife and his children, and he said, yeah, he said, Bunting, yeah, that's his car. So I'm just doing my thing, taking my pictures and videos, and Bronwyn's doing notes and doing that sort of stuff. Because at this stage, I've also given notice that I'm leaving SAPOL, and I've told them I'm already moving to Queensland because it's the 20th of May, and I've left pretty much about the 18th of June, I think, was my last official day. So yep. I've given them notice I'm finishing up. So, Bronwyn's doing, she's doing most of the notes and reporting on it. And like I said, it was a straight in, straight out job until the detectives called us across and said, you won't believe what he's just told us. I said, what do you mean? They said, well, he's just told us that Bunting has come here with some barrels in the back of this four-wheel drive that they were interested in, and they're now over at the old State Bank. I went, oh, okay. So we down tools immediately and went to the old State Bank, drove around, and as police do, you think you know where you're going. We just followed the detectives, and they'd gone to what turned out to be the old ANZ bank to start with. Of course, the key didn't work because this fellow gave him a key, and they said, how do we get in? He said, well, I've got to give you the key. So he pulled a bunch of keys out of his pocket and took a key off and said, that's the side door. So they said, so I'll come with you. And they said, no, you better stay here. So he's wandered. We've gone over there. Some little elderly lady was walking along the street, could see these grown men look a little bit confused and befuddled at the side street. And she's going, can I help you? And they're going, we're looking for the state. Oh, no, this one, dear, around the corner. So poor old Snowtown, like many towns in Australia, and the whole town was sort of in decline at that stage. It's going backwards. Mm. They're closing banks left, right, centre. So we've gone around to the correct State Bank, walked and got around to the side door, and we could smell what we thought was cannabis. And that turned out to be just a plant in the garden outside the manager's house, because they still had the manager's residence was attached to the bank, and there was a lady who was not involved in this at all, was just renting this house with the manager's residence, and the fella across the road, he was renting the old bank, and as part of that, he had access to the bank vault as well as the manager's office and those sorts of things. So we've gone in with the key. I've got the video running. Walking through, there's no smell. There's nothing really suspicious other than that, you know, you can see all these computer bits and broken, dismantled video recorders and computer bits and pieces, because this is what this fella at the house did. He was repairing for a couple of electrical shops nearby. He was repairing computers and doing warranty work and TVs and things. So he was using the old bank space for that sort of thing. So we've gone in, had a look around. And then we can't get into the vault. The bank vault itself was closed and locked. I felt the tumbler that was just didn't feel like it was connected, but it still had a big handle on it and a fairly large keyhole. And I said, oh. So detectives went off and scurried away to do things, to talk about thermal lances and, you know, cutting holes in it. And I thought, well, the last thing we want is thermal lances generate tremendous heat, flames and smoke, and it was just, no, that is the very last thing we're going to do. So they all went off to try and make some inquiries about how we might get a safe cracker to come and help us get into the safe. So by now, it's now sort of lunchtime-ish. I haven't had lunch. I'm getting hungry. Bronwyn, she's got her lunch with her because she knew she was coming up for the day. So I've walked back and I said, before we do too much more, we better fingerprint the vault or the safe door. So because this job didn't involve fingerprinting, she didn't bring a fingerprint kit with her from Adelaide. So mine was still in the car. So my car was across the road. So I've gone back, walked out of the bank, back over the, cross over the railway line, walked across the embankments and to the house where the local police officers in the car with the occupant of the house. And they said, you know, how's he getting on? I said, oh, we've got in, we're getting so far, but we can't get into the vault. And he said, oh, and he leans across. He said, oh, I said, no, you want to get in? He said, you don't. You just need a piece of wire. He said, the combination tumbler thing doesn't work. He said, yeah, I figured that. And I said, well, I better find a bit of wire there. So I'll get you some. So he's jumped out of the car and he's taken me to the side of his house. And he's got this giant, great big roll of number 8 fencing wire that you know, most farmers would have. It's this big roll. It's like a metre high and it's a metre wide. So he cuts me off this length of wire, bends it up at right angles and puts a little hook in the end of it. And he said, it's like, so it looks like a little divining rod. And he hands it. He said, do you want me to come? I said, no, you better not. You better not come with me. You stay here. So I remember going back over, walking back. I got my car, drove back over, and I've got the fingerprint kit ready, and I've walked into the bank, and at this stage there's just Bronwyn there, and there's Greg Stone was lurking around. I said, oh, I've got the key, and I've held up this piece of wire, and the look they gave me was just, yeah, well, you can imagine.
Priceless.
Yeah, it was that, yeah, you're an idiot. You know? We knew you were stupid, but now you're really an idiot.
But now it's confirmed.
That's right. Yeah. So I thought, well, and the local cop had offered to go down to the bakery. He's going to go and get me a pie or something. He was going to buy me something at the bakery and he was going to drop it back off on his way back. So that was awesome. So while I had a couple of minutes to kill, I'm on the floor and I thought, well, I'll put this piece of wire into the keyhole and just like the occupant had said, so I'm starting to fiddle around. I could see the tumblers because the keyhole was really, really quite large. So I could see the tumblers. I'm just fiddling around with it. I've got my hand on the lever handle. And I think nobody's more surprised than me when my hand just fell on the weight of the handle. It opened. I went, hey, we're in. And so complete shock and awe across everybody's face. The idiot's come back with a piece of wire and he actually cracked into a safe. Who would have thought? So then we opened the door and I said, hang on, I'll get the video. So I've got the video running. We've opened the door and met with just a sheet of black plastic, completely sealed, sticky tape all around the door, all four, top, bottom sides, the whole lot, just a big sheet of plastic with a vertical slit that's also taped up. So we thought, oh, it is. We thought it was going to be hydroponics crop all the way along. I think that's what it is. It's the black plastic you find in many places.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, white on one side, heavy duty, sort of black on the other. So we're thinking,
dead giveaway.
Yeah, we're thinking, yep. Yeah, it's dope. Mm. Yeah, it's dope.
Yeah.
So then Greg then peels off the sticky tape on the centre part, which is obviously the intended entry, and pretty much straight away we get hit with the smell. I thought, no, it's not dope. And then with a torch, we can shine the torch in through the slot on the video camera. You can actually see the heap of barrels. Standing up on its end is a green lounge suite, which was on one of the items on the list. So we found at least one of the items on that list. I remember seeing the lounge suite thinking, that's a big item. So they've got that standing up there. The lounge suite's on its end. There's a couple of other matching chairs in there as well. So the whole lounge suite's inside this vault in one corner. And then at the other end is the 8 black barrels. And we can see handcuffs. We can see like a knife set and things like some rubber gloves sort of been hastily removed on top of the barrels. And thought, okay, this is suddenly gone really pear-shaped.
My goodness.
Poor Bronwyn now is going, oh, I've never – she spent most of the afternoon worried, understandably, that she'd never really done a murder on her own. This was what she was going to have to report on. So she's suddenly gone from zero to, you know, 6 or more bodies in the space of an hour. certainly within the space of a couple of hours. So I said, you'll be fine. We'll work through this and we'll get it done. So straight on the phone, as you do, you ring Adelaide office back and say, you sold us a pup. Thanks very much. I've now got this job. And then detectives obviously have gone and done the same thing. They've rung up their higher bosses. So a few hours later, we've got an army of people that have come up, forensic people, photographic people, detectives from major crime have all turned up. And then there's the debate was happening about, we don't even know what we're dealing with yet. We need to get those barrels open. We need to see what's in there. And on top of the lounge suite, I'd seen four drums of hydrochloric acid. And I thought, that's interesting. So somebody rang the chemist in Adelaide and said, look, what sort of risk is this going to be? And they said, well, it's not going to, you know, eat your skin as such, but the vapors and the fumes from that could be quite dangerous because it's essentially chlorine, which is liquid chlorine, yes, basically, for anyone who's not chemically minded. So there's these drums of chlorine bleach type stuff. I think in hindsight, the offenders probably thought it was going to be dissolving their body parts. Yeah, they wanted something stronger, but that's probably what they could go and buy at Bunnings or whatever. So, excuse me, they said, you know, you probably need to take some respiratory protection in there. So I'd spent a number of years as a volunteer firefighter in the Country Fire Service in South Australia. So I had some training and experience with using breathing apparatus that the fire brigade, you know, the tank on your back and the mask over your face. So I said to one of my local detectives, if you can get me some breathing apparatus from the local volunteer fire station, I can use it. So he said, oh, I'll see what I can do. So, because he was, you know, he'd been a long time detective in the country. He was very well connected with people around town. So he found the boss of the local fire brigade and said, look, I need to borrow some breathing apparatus. I can't tell you why. I can't tell you when, but I can tell you that I've got someone who knows how to use it. So we don't need you to come with us, and we'll return it in good condition. Can you help me? And he went, sure, I'll do that. So he hands him this thing. So Rick Day's come back with this breathing apparatus kit. So I've then put it on, got ready, and then I've gone in and unscrewed the tops of the barrels to actually have a look at what's inside. So, and doing that, people outside are trying to see if there's a vapor, any sort of smells coming out that are likely to be harmful. As it turned out, there was nothing terribly harmful. So we worked out pretty quickly we could probably go in without breathing apparatus. But I kept that on because of the smell and the absolute stench that was in there. I kept that on just for my own comfort until I ran out of air. So I just kept going. And then once the air ran out, no choice, just like everyone else, we had to just deal with the smells.
Can I go back just a minute there, mm-hmm. Gordon? You said that when you went in there after you've got through the black plastic that there was this terrible smell. Did you immediately believe that that smell was a dead body, or, like, did you know immediately what it was? Because at this stage you haven't actually you don't actually know there's a body in that barrel, do you? You may assume, but you don't know. Would that be right?
That's right, yes. We had barrels, we had saws, we had knives, we had handcuffs and some rubber gloves, but we actually didn't know what was in those barrels. But the smell was a pretty good giveaway. There was something very dead in that room. Wow. So once you've smelt, I guess, decomposing flesh, it's a smell you never forget. And that had that distinct smell about it. I remember looking at the video days later, and then, you know, Greg's put his head back out and he's going, oh, it's not dope. He knew the smell was completely different. So, we knew we had a body or something.
So I interrupted. So you've run out of air, you've taken off your breathing apparatus, and what happens then?
And then we just started to process each barrel one at a time. We hatched a plan once the guys from Adelaide and the rest of the support team have arrived. We said, well, we labelled all the barrels up A through to F, and then we made note of what was in each one, like where they were within the vault, you know, their positioning, so, you know, a little mud map. And of course, Bronwyn's doing most of the notes on this because she's going to be reporting on it.
Poor Bronwyn.
Poor Bronwyn,
God.
Yeah, poor Bronwyn.
In at the deep end.
Oh, very much so, I really felt for her because she hasn't travelled very well ever since then. She's out of the job, so that's one of my pet gripes with SAPOL, because I rang the following day and said, look, she was quite overawed by it all. Keep an eye on her. So they went, yep, no worries. So what are they going to do? Go for another 3 or 4 days straight working at all these other scenes, and, you know, the secondary scenes where these people had been abducted from and where the torture and stuff had happened. Mentally it didn't do her any good whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So
Gordon, when you – let's just – we don't need to go through the six barrels, mm-hmm. but can you tell us sort of step by step what happens when how you open the barrel, what you see or what you smell, what do you do when you realise it's a body? Like, is there body parts in there? Can you just take us through that?
I remember opening several of them. I can't tell you which barrel was which anymore without looking at my notes and stuff. But yeah, open the lid, and I remember one was one had sort of soil and garbage bags in it as well, but I could see like a slightly mummified foot was sort of sticking up near the top. I thought, okay, that's a human foot. And I said to the guys, so they said, this has been exhumed from somewhere because it had soil all over it. It had previously been buried in soil and was now inside this barrel. So there was a couple like that, and then you could see another one. You could see a torso that was still wearing some jeans, and there was a leather belt on the jeans. It was sort of folded up inside. So it was, if you can imagine, I guess, somebody bending over and then being just shoved into a barrel. I could see the yep. back of their belt, that sort of thing. Another one was pretty much full of liquid and floating on the top of the liquid, and that's the one that had most of the hydrochloric acid in it, was the was like a just a bare leg, like a fairly plump calf, human calf and foot. I thought, okay.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Okay, so that's the sort of stuff we're dealing with. So we had some that were full of liquid, some that were semi-full of liquid, and some that were appeared to be quite dry. So it wasn't practical, and we didn't have the space or the manpower to do them then. So we said, we've got to get these to the mortuary where we can, you know, document them all properly, and they can be examined, you know, by a forensic pathologist. So, again, the local detective went back, drove back to Kadena an hour or so, picked up the station trailer, which was a cage trailer, brought it back, and then about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, we've then, inside the vault was a little tiny little knocked down, runabout, really worn out, I call it a sack truck, a little trolley thing that we use for museum furniture and sort of stuff. So there was one of those inside the vault. So we ended up using that to take these barrels out through the front of the bank, out across the footpath, manhandled them into the trailer, and then he had to drive it straight to Adelaide that night, and they got checked in at 2 o'clock in the morning or something, left at the mortuary where the team the following day were going to start exhuming them out, documenting what was in what, and some had, you know, one or two torsos and extra legs and not enough arms and legs, so it was a bit of a Meccano set for them as they were trying to piece it all together. And they got it all done, looking at tattoos and things like that. That were still, you know, even though the decomposition's occurring, their tattoos and stuff are often still visible. So those are the things they used to identify a lot of the people with, as well as, you know, DNA in the end. But they did all that stuff, and then We had to go on. We went back the following day. We did eventually just shut the scene down because we were just exhausted by then. We've manhandled all this stuff and we've made copious notes. Your brain's just about to explode from all this information overload. You're thinking, trying to do everything in the right order, not trying to mess it all up because, as you would remember, if you do something out of sequence, it might damage your evidence in the next bit. So you've got to be conscious that whatever you do, we need to make sure we're doing it all in the right sequence, and what we do now is not going to affect someone later this afternoon or tomorrow or whatever it might be. It was a big joint effort on everybody's part. And then the following day, we've got other people from Adelaide have come up and they've gone to process the rest of the stuff in the vault, which was garbage bags full of clothes and possessions and bits and pieces. We found there was a notebook inside the doorway, which I forgot about the first part. Once we opened the vault, because the doors are so thick, they're about a foot thick, so they're roughly 30 odd centimetres deep. We've got a very large door frame. So in the door frame, there was a notebook, like a school exercise book, one of those little, not an A4 one, but a smaller size, very common with primary schools in particular. And that had a list of names in it. And some of those names had been crossed out and others were still going. So I believe that they were going to be, they were future victims. Just another.
God, they were next. Yeah,
it was a hit list of sorts, yeah.
Oh, God.
There was a pair of sand shoes there as well and a wallet. For a name we didn't know about. When we checked, he was the victim. He was killed the night before we were there. I think it was the night before. He was the very last victim. He'd been lured there on the guise to buy a computer, a second-hand computer. So he was driven up there and they lured him in there and then they tortured them and then they do the cutting up on the floor because there was all this extra black plastic and stuff on the floor in there. And we'd even felt when we sat on the floor to have lunch and do some notes, we thought that the carpet tiles were a bit damp. So remember, we lifted a couple of carpet tiles and did a COMBA test, like a test for blood. It came back negative, but they were obviously hosing down the blood and stuff and making the carpet wet as they cleaned up after themselves.
So, Gordon, why were these people murdered and by who?
It was pretty much greed in the end. It started off as what they would consider community service. They were trying to rid the world of people they believe were pedophiles, were homosexual, or transgender sort of people that we would call today. So anyone who was not quite what they would consider normal, anyone who had different sexual orientation or strange views, and some of this was completely wrong. They were targeting people that they believed were pedophiles, and there was never any evidence of this. But in their mind, they said, no, this person's, they were rock spiders. They had names for them like that. And they said, no, this one's got to go. Yeah. So they had like a kill list. And then I think at some point, probably fairly early on, they realized that they're still getting paid Centrelink money. Most of these people were, and that was their target group, was a lot of these people were on the fringes of society. They'd been, for whatever reason, were estranged from a lot of their families and
almost
that sort of stuff.
Almost discarded by the community.
Yeah, didn't have a lot of friends as such or associated only with themselves and their own, all the other victims. Yep. So it was a fairly small group in the northern suburbs of Adelaide mostly, and their families didn't always speak to them regularly. So if they hadn't been heard from in 3 or 4 or 6 months, that wasn't unusual for the family. That didn't ring any bells or didn't start alarming anyone. So once they realised this was happening and they worked out they could actually get their Centrelink money. So Centrelink keep paying money. Even though they're a missing person, the money still goes into the bank. So then they started getting they were torturing them to get their PIN numbers and so forth.
Oh,
and then they would then go to ATMs and get money out. And actually, one of them actually went on holiday because at one point there was a public appeal during the whole thing. This is before I got involved, but there was a public appeal for this missing woman and someone rang the Missing Persons Bureau in Adelaide and said, hey, I know she's not really missing. She's actually in Tasmania on holiday. She just doesn't want her family to know and she's having a bit of a break. So they did some checks on the bank records and sure enough, there's transactions in Tasmania. What we know now is that those transactions were being done by their offender, who was the person who rang and said, oh, she's actually in Tasmania. And it was just threw them off, and no one at the Missing Persons Bureau checked more than just to say, okay, we did this, because these people are adults. So with adult missing people, the system certainly back then was that a lesser inquiry is made, really, because they're seen to be probably able to look after themselves and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And that's the skill, I suppose, of your friend who was the initial person where he thought what was your friend's name? Your mate?
Greg Stone.
Greg. Yeah. So that's why people like Greg are so good at what they do because having worked at missing persons, they are really challenging investigations because, as you just alluded to there, a lot of people go missing because for all sorts of reasons, that they may have had a breakup. They might need to, it might be somebody trying to get away and just finding somewhere to just get themselves together, like going to a refuge. They might want to go missing.
Yes.
But the skill is to identify, is this a crime or is this just somebody wanting, a bit of space? And also your mate Greg, he obviously had that gut feeling that so many police have. I would think the majority of police have, where something doesn't feel right. And it was through Greg's, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's through Greg's gut feeling and a couple of pieces of information that were actually starting to look like there is something very wrong here. And it was only through Greg, obviously, that this was discovered.
That's always been my understanding of it. Yes, he told me that on the day he was explaining. He said, in a sort of a weird, and this will sound perhaps sick to some people, but you'll understand it as ex-police.
Yeah.
He was feeling almost pleased that we'd found something substantial, bodies, because it completely vindicated him, and he was basically going to have the last laugh on certainly his senior bosses at the local CIB, and all the work that had gone in, that he put into it, putting the files together, it basically justified all of those things. And he said, I was right all along. And you said, it's your gut. Always trust your gut as a copper.
Yeah, that's true. And so there's a couple of other questions I want to ask, but so who was it? Were they a group of friends that had committed these murders, or do you know who they were and how they knew one another, and how were they men, women?
They're all men. John Bunting was the main man. He was the main person. He lived at I think Salisbury North at the end, the main part, because all these people lived in the sort of the Salisbury, Elizabeth areas, the northern suburbs of Adelaide. Weirdly enough, the areas I grew up in, Salisbury North, the actual house where they originally buried some of the people, was in my early patrol district. Part of the Parry Hills patrol district way back then. I don't think Parry Hills even exists anymore as a police station. So you've got John Bunting. We've got Wagner was the other one. And then we've also got a third one whose name escapes me at the moment.
So there was three men, were there?
Predominantly three men. There was a fourth one. It was a young lad. His surname was Vesakis. Could be misspelled like V-S, something rather.
Yep.
He managed to get himself tangled up in them, and he was sort of fearful that he was going to be the next victim because he had a terrible drug problem and was pretty much being abused by them to assist them to help with these things. And I think he was the one who led the last victim up there because they were mates, similar ages, early 20s, that sort of stuff, late teens, early 20s.
Do you know if the offenders ever confessed, or was it just the overwhelming evidence that you had?
I don't think they've ever confessed. I don't believe they ever got a confession from them. We did get, I think Vesakis did become a Crown witness. I think, in protective custody, or he had his identity changed and those sorts of things to protect him.
Mm.
So he assisted with some of it, but the evidence was fairly compelling. They found property at their houses and stuff, and there was, when they tracked through some of the transactions, there's even CCTV footage at a service station of one of, I think it's Bunting, going to the ATM, actually using one of the dead people's ATM card to draw money out. Those sorts of things were pretty damning. And, of course, they had surveillance on them for a little while. And they're watching him do some of these things. I don't know if they actually saw them transferring money, but we had to keep the challenge at Snowtown was that the bank, the Old State Bank, was actually literally on the opposite corner to the local pub. So while this is happening around about tea time, the pub's now getting a number of people starting to turn up, regular patrons. So we're trying to keep a low profile without drawing attention to all the people in the pub.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, well, they did pretty well because we worked ourselves inside and we were keeping only a few cars like out the front to try and make it look less suspicious. But we're right in the corner, so we can't move all these barrels and things out until the pub closes. And luckily back then the pubs was generally closing about 10 o'clock, so we just waited. When eventually the pub closed, the town was sort of in darkness, was like a ghost town, and that's when we could then start moving these things out because the major crime people had decided we are going to put the surveillance back on to our suspects because when this story breaks, we want to watch and know where they're going.
Yeah.
So that meant late night phone calls to surveillance operatives, getting them out of bed and stuff, and get ready. You're going to be on this from now. Get yourself down to these various locations, and we had to keep a media ban on it until the following day. So I think it was by the time the news had broken, and it somehow did break sort of around dawn, I think, but the surveillance was in place and they saw some of these people apparently went off and were dumping stuff in industrial bins and stuff at shopping centres and bits and pieces. Oh, so they all become secondary scenes for forensic and for police to get involved in. But we were lucky to be able to, I guess, stall the investigation long enough or stall the media release long enough to get ourselves in position to get ready for these things. So it's important.
Yeah, I was thinking to myself as you're telling me, I'm thinking to myself, and I imagine Snowtown is a small town. Do you know the population of Snowtown, like roughly? Is it a one horse town? Is it along those sort of lines?
Pretty much. I mean, it had a district primary school that kids would come to. But I honestly would guess. I think at the time this happened, I'd be surprised if the population was greater than about 700. 300, okay. 300 is what I would say, but the surrounding area collectively might be 700 people.
Yeah, because my point being that in a small country town like Snowtown obviously is or was, you don't have to do much for the people to start talking. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder how many people were starting to watch and thinking, you wouldn't put the crime scene tape out, I imagine, because that just, it's like bees to a honeypot, isn't it?
That's right.
So it was obviously inside the bank. So, I was thinking, God, how did you keep the media and the observers away, but just under the cover of darkness?
Yeah, it was fortunate, I guess, the time of the day it all happened because we were inside. It wasn't an outdoor scene. We could go through the back door, the side entrance, and there was a big high, fence, like a 6 or 7 foot tall, a colourbond fence at the very front, which provided privacy for the people in the old manager's house. It also gave us a great privacy because we could work behind there. We could bring vehicles and things into the backyard of the house and nobody would know what we were doing. So it was only until we opened the front doors. And then once the news broke, there was satellite. News crews came with satellite dishes. I remember there was even some Japanese people in the end by the time they all packed up. The international interest from it. The road was just almost jammed full with opposite side of the road was jammed full with media outlets and all this stuff.
Hey, Gordon, the barrels, were they what we would assume what we would see these days as wine barrels? Is that what they were, a wine barrel?
These were actually olive. They were used as plastic barrels. They were originally they had olives in them. They were sort of reused olive barrels. So they're not like a 44-gallon drum. They were plastic. These ones were all black. But more recently, you'll probably see the exactly the same style of barrel. It's often a bright blue colour with a black lid.
I know the
plastic ones. Yeah. So they might use them in the wine industry, but they weren't wine barrels in the traditional sense. I think these originally had one of them was labelled like olive barrels and stuff, and they'd come from a surplus supply place in Adelaide.
And did they have a lid on them?
Yes. Yeah, they have they have like a screw-on ring and that holds on. There's a push-in lid that fits in the top.
Yep.
So there's a rubber seal, push the lid in, and then you basically hold that little inserted lid on with a screw top Screwjob wing. So those ones.
And Gordon, this is obviously a huge job in a huge investigation in anyone's career. Mm. How can you remember how you felt knowing what you were finding in every barrel, like the fact that the bodies had obviously been dismembered? Did it make you feel, I mean, I think poor Bronwyn, obviously it affected her, but there wouldn't be many people that wouldn't affect, would there?
Oh, no, I think it's one of those jobs where you know, you get that sense that this is big, you know. Even though you don't quite know how big it's going to be, you know that straight away this is a big thing, because, you know, Sonny's already told us he's been working on this for months or years, whatever it was, and he said there's, you know, this number of similarities we're talking about. You know, he's been able to match, I think, you know, four or five people he thought were probably all murdered at that point. I don't even think he may have realised just how big it really was. Yeah. And the weird thing was that I did a skeletal recovery in just north of Adelaide in 1995, it was. Myself and another lady there, that was, we did a skeletal recovery in a sheep paddock. A sheep had unearthed a skull. And it turned out that he was the very first victim back in 1995, and he never got identified. We never identified the body back then, because one of the possible victims that we were given a list of potential people, the picture was given to the forensic odontologist at the time and said, is this the person? And he looked at the picture and he said, no, he said, it can't be, because he's got, from looking at the picture, he's got distinct, you know, chips in his front teeth, and our skull, our teeth didn't have that. So he said, can't be him. All those years later, after Snowtown happened, and you realise that this victim, Clinton Drezice, his name was, his remains were the first ones. He ran in the same circles and friends as all the other Snowtown victims. He was, I think, living, questionably, was in a relationship with Barry Lane, who was a later victim. And he, so we, because we couldn't identify him back then, I guess Snowtown continued. Had we identified him back then, had we had more pictures or better dental records, maybe we would have selected Clinton Drezice, and then, you know, inquiries would have been made with his circle of friends. Some of those people, you know, have since become victims. So we would have found, probably, we may not have had as many, or we may have just stopped Snowtown altogether. But, yeah, it didn't happen. In 95, so there was at least 4 years when they were running around doing this sort of stuff.
And you did say that there was six barrels. Mm-hmm. Am I assuming that in those six barrels there were six body part, six bodies?
Eight bodies
in six barrels.
Yeah.
Okay, but you did say initially that there were 14 victims. Where were the other six?
One was Clinton's Ice back in the sheep paddock.
Oh, the 95 one.
There was a couple they found the remains buried under a rainwater tank at the back of Salisbury North, where one of the offenders had lived in the past. Okay. So there was a couple more there. And there was another one, I think. I can't remember if the body was, because I didn't do these scenes. These were done by people in Adelaide, because I still had my other stuff to get on with, and I already had to take a bit of a step back a little bit, because I'd given notice I was finishing up. I did say, look, I'll stay on if you want, and they said, no, there's no need for that. They had enough other people, and of course they did. Yeah. But there was someone had at least temporarily put one of the bodies into a mechanics pit inside a domestic garage. That sort of stuff, and that was examined, because some of these they sort of moved them around a bit. I think they had, as the bodies were starting to sort of mount up, they needed to move it, because they were often just renting these places. You know, they were government housing. In Queensland here they call it, you know, public, it's public housing, I guess, any state you live in. So when they moved houses, they had to take some of the bodies with them, apart from on Sorcery North. So some of this stuff, the bodies got moved around a little bit. One was buried in an acreage property at a place called Hoyleton, out towards Port Wakefield again. And that was another exhumed, that was one of the exhumed ones, I think, was in the barrels. But the telephone intercepts had detected that they had discussions about, I think I've got a boat we can use, or I found a boat. And as well as the six barrels, inside the manager's office at the bank, there was six bags of cement, of concrete. So I think the plan was they were going to have a bag of concrete in each barrel. The barrels were going to go onto a boat, and they were going to, because they'd been followed to Port Wakefield, which is a coastal town between Snowtown and Adelaide. And it's a very quiet coastal town, right on the edge of the, there's a military firing zone there. There's a no-go zone for boats, which sort of borders at Port Wakefield. So if you were brave enough and, you know, didn't care, and these people were clearly both, they could have just ducked on the boat. They could have gone into the military area, dumped the barrels, and basically nobody would probably ever find them. Unless they float up, they wouldn't accidentally be discovered, anchor drop or something like that. So I think, given that they were followed, one of them was at least followed there, and there was discussions about maybe I've sourced a boat. The six barrels, six bags of concrete, I think, yeah, we got there before they had a chance to enact the next step of their plan, which was to probably dump them all at sea.
God, I wonder if you hadn't have, intercepted this investigation, whether they just would have continued, because obviously they're getting money from Centrelink and, it's all going well. But I was going to say, in one sense, they weren't actually dills, were they, the offenders?
Oh, no. No, they weren't. They weren't completely stupid. One of them fronted up, I believe, at Centrelink for an interview, because one of these victims had been sent a letter saying, you need to come in and see us for whatever reason. So they've turned up and said, I am whichever victim it was, I am Narelle Fraser. I'm here to talk to you about my letter you've sent me. And then Centrelink just did their interview, whatever they did, and marked it off. So I just said right back then, I don't think it's happened yet. My strong belief back then and still today is that if someone becomes an official missing person, Centrelink or the government benefits should probably just be shut off in the hope that might force them to surface somewhere. And if they want to remain missing, that's okay. But we need to know where these people are, because what we've got happening, and this has happened in other cases you read about, where partners and things get killed and they continue to get their pension or whatever it might be, their benefits, continue on. And if we can stop that, we might at least flag earlier that something's not right with this particular missing person.
We've done very well for just having a quick chat about Snowtown. But I know exactly what you mean, Gordon, because I can hear, like, those sort of jobs really come along pretty rarely. Mm. And when they do, it's something that you will never, ever forget. And I know, with a couple of big investigations that I've been involved in, I could almost – almost minute by minute, you never forget it. But it's a great feeling in another way to think that you've been part of a team that have solved such a huge job. And you've also obviously saved a lot of other people, but being victims, it sounds like they just, went from one to the other. But I can hear in your voice, this sounds silly, how much you love that's what I miss about being in the police force, is just getting those jobs and, you're exhausted, but it's just adrenaline and, it's wrong, isn't it? Because it's somebody's family, it's somebody's loved one, but just to be able to identify who it is and be involved in that whole thing. Oh God, I miss that.
it certainly is a contradiction of feelings, isn't it? You get that real positive, yes, I'm doing something great here. But of course, the upshot, the positive from all this is that we've now got 14 families and friends, associates, that know what happened to their loved one. No one's now left wondering. We've got, I believe, hundreds of people around Australia that are missing people that are never found. They never know what happens to them. But at least in the case of Snowtown, as horrible and horrendous as everything was, and the torture that happened and the way that they died is awful, but at least their families know, and they've got, if they can try to move on as best they can with that knowledge that, they've been able to bury their loved one and say a proper goodbye. A lot of families don't get that. So
no, they don't. And So you have been, as you I said in the beginning, in my introduction, like some of the jobs that you've been involved in. Personally, I would think Snowtown would be, that is up there. But also you're involved in the 1994 NCA, the National Crime Authority bombing at the South Australia Police Headquarters, weren't you? Which at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was one of the first really large-scale bombings that Australia had known. Can you tell us a bit about that? What an incredible investigation Gordon has just taken us through. It's hard to get your head around, isn't it, the fact that he envisaged just ticking off one more job before heading home, thinking a few photos and he'd be home for lunch with his wife. 8 bodies later, he did finally get home. It proves just how varied policing can be and how you never know what's around the corner, or in Gordon's case, behind some black plastic sheets. So many of us have been there policing. What starts out as some routine inquiry just gets bigger and bigger by the minute. Next week, Gordon takes us through another high-profile investigation, and that is into the bombing of the NCA headquarters, the National Crime Authority headquarters in South Australia, where a drug detective lost his life and a solicitor who was sitting across the desk from that detective. He didn't die but had lifelong injuries after a parcel exploded in the detective's lap. The intricate work involved in identifying the offender is just incredible. Due to the bomb exploding on the 12th floor, obviously emergency service vehicles flooded the area. And Gordon tells us of the painstaking work of picking out bits of glass and paper from the wheels of a fire truck parked under the window that exploded, and how all those tiny, minuscule pieces of evidence assisted in enabling the offender to be identified. Just amazing work. Gordon also takes us through the day he had what he calls a breakdown of sorts, and it certainly sounds like that. But within maybe about 10 days, he was back at work and he never had another incident like it. But he tells of the importance of trusting the professionals and trying what they suggest, because that's why he was able to return to work. Oh, and of course, he had an understanding and supportive workplace and his colleagues who understood and with whom he opened up and shared how he felt. Just an incredible man. Anyway, have a great week and we'll talk next week. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.